Welcome. You're listening to Ireland Life with myself, David Kinley, a series of programmes entitled New World, Old Ways, where we discuss the history, culture, folklore, superstitions and music of the Manx emigrees to the New World, the USA and in particular the Appalachian Mountains. In this programme, we'll be looking at the history of a very versatile musical instrument that over the centuries has become to epitomise the sound of American folk music, the banjo. But is it even American? I went to talk to banjo aficionado, Mr. John Woodman.
So the banjo,
as we know it, is probably as synonymous and as iconic to the United States of America as the golden eagle, the great eagle. However, it goes back much further than that. We got the first recording of the banjo. And how many different names do you know? I've got banja, banya, banya, banger, banza, and panjo, which is quite interesting.
Panjo's new to me, but all sorts of variants on P-A-N with a suffix. So, but banjar is the most common alternative, I think.
Right. I like the one with the J-A on the end, a banjo. That sounds very Manx, that does. Yeah. I was imagining the Manx for anything. Hell, banjo at you. But it goes back 1687 in Jamaica, which is quite amazing. And as far as I can find in my research, is the oldest physical banjo we can find is from the 1770s. It was actually picked up in the 1777 in Suriname. Suriname and South America, Northwest South America, where of course the Dutch guys, the colonialists there, they'd brought a lot of guys from places like Guinea and Guyana and sort of West Coast guys. And so what I thought initially this banjo might have been something like started off as an oud from Persia. No. A lute from England. No. It's very, very much African, isn't it?
It's African. I mean, a lot of Americans won't thank you for pointing that out, because it is American, pure and simple, but there's really no doubt that it came from West Africa by and large with slaves to the West Indies and that region, and then upwards from there into the slave states of America. And from there, it gets complicated, but it's an African instrument.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with the oud.
Nothing at all.
So scotch that.
It's
Africa going west. It's not Persia going
To Europe
and then...
Yeah, so it hasn't developed. It's completely separate from anything like a guitar or anything, isn't
nothing
it?
Nothing like a guitar.
No, not at all. And, it's recorded all over the place. Cuba, Haiti, St. Vincent, Barbados. Yeah. And then some of the earliest recordings of it arriving in the United States was via New Orleans, of course. Yeah. Places like that, the Carolinas, the other East Coast ports. So,
of course, New Orleans had a fantastic influence on American music of so many styles.
For a long period.
New Orleans is the most sort of cosmopolitan / European
diversity
in the US. So all sorts of things spread out from New Orleans.
Yeah. Would it be fair to say that in the 1700s, the 18th century, that the banjo in America would have been exclusively an Afro-American instrument?
I think it would. I think it only became an instrument played by white folks in, I suspect, not much before the beginning of the 19th century. And that would have been mostly as a result of contact between rural white populations and black populations. It only then became gradually taken up by polite society, if you like, in the middle of the 19th century, 1840, 1850. And from that point onwards, it had a very spectacular rise in society.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, of course, in the 1700s, the 18th century is a lot of, you know, this is when the settlements are really going on up in the hollows of the Appalachian Mountains. Yeah. And, of course, slavery is still rife, let's say. Yeah. So it's interesting to know when the white settlers actually start to pick up these instruments. I can imagine this is just a slow integration of how they brought their songs over. And
I think it's a slow integration. You've got settlers coming in large numbers from Scotland, Ireland, Scotch Irish, bringing with them their musical heritage, bringing with them fiddles, meeting with guys who can play the banjo. It's not going to take long before the black guys are playing the fiddle and the white guys are realising that actually these two fit pretty well together and you can get something very attractive out of one, not a conscious thing, but the two things naturally came together. Now, when that was, I've no idea, but I would guess, again, sort of early 1800s, something like that.
Radio, yeah. Okay. So in the 1800s, the white folk really, at some period, really get involved, but not in an Appalachian folk sort of way. Minstrel bands. How would you describe a minstrel band?
Well, minstrel bands were huge. Mm. And they did all sorts of, they carried out, they performed all sorts of functions. I mean, they were, how to put into words, it's
an entertainment show.
It was a show. It was sometimes it was black, sometimes it was whites playing a heavily black influenced repertoire. But it was done for show. So it might be done as part of somebody there flogging patent medicine. It might be done as any sort of gathering. You might have a minstrel band, but it took off very, very quickly from, I'm not sure the date, but I would guess sort of 1840 or something like that, and probably peaked in the, I don't know, towards the end of the 19th century. I mean, it was quite innovative when they started, but it's quite repetitive. And when you I suspect when you've seen one or two minstrel shows, you've seen them all.
Yeah.
So it was sort of a bit of a boom and bust.
Yeah. Just, as I mentioned on a previous program, when the Erie Canal had been built and then as access, that's when New York really became big time. That became the main seaport for the Atlantic coast, and of course it was pretty much twinned with Liverpool, and of course these minstrel bands, this sort of influence then comes over to the British Isles, really, because it was very, very popular in Victorian halls.
Yes.
So this is probably the first period where these instruments are being played in a big entertainment style, really, as opposed to what we think of a banjo as an Appalachian folk instrument.
Yeah. So certainly there were minstrel shows became, I think, pretty well known in English entertainment circles. How widespread they were, or whether it was primarily a London thing, I don't know.
Yeah.
Then I mean, I'm making this up as I go along, but that then spreads out into Piro shows.
Yeah.
Piro troops often had a banjo player. Now, what the times of that are, I don't know, it must be turn of the 19th, 20th century primarily.
Yeah, absolutely. But after the American Civil War, I'm led to believe from what I've researched is that the Afro-American guys, they get their freedom pretty much.
Mm.
And then it becomes a predominantly white instrument because the Afro-American guys are going, we're going to play pianos and violins and cellos like you guys do. We end up with jazz.
I'm sure that's right, but at the same time, there's the black community isn't one sort of, it's not a whole, so there'll be musically sophisticated blacks who go down the sort of ragtime jazz pathway. Equally in isolated areas, there'll still be black communities that do very much the same things they were doing 50 or 100 years ago. But it did have this, it's interesting because until the turn of the 20th century, the black community in America was very, very wary of being associated with the banjo in any way. And I know personally a couple of women who were young at that time who wanted to play old-time banjo.
Yeah.
And they were very much, that was frowned on by their musical community because of the association with old-time pre-Civil War stuff. So it's a thing to be avoided rather than embraced as part of their heritage. I think that's changed a bit, but as I said earlier, Americans, or white Americans, see the banjo as a white instrument. They associate it mostly with bluegrass, which is a white American music. They would be quite hostile to the idea that it is, that most of what the banjo is about comes from the black community.
What a turnaround after 200 years.
Yeah.
Gosh. And of course, when we get to the late 19th century in this period that we're talking about, if you look through the history books, musicology history books, and you see these photographs of bands, and some of them are minstrel bands, and some of them are playing some quite high end, sort of almost like parlor type of music.
Yeah.
So a lot of the listeners here will just be thinking, really, they're playing high end music and quartets and sextets.
Once the banjo started to become an acceptable instrument in white society, there was a huge boom in banjo production. And as well as the five-string banjo that probably most people have seen, there were also equivalents of mandolins or violins, violas, cellos, bass. So there was a mandolin banjo, which is like a violin. There was I can't think of the one in between, but there was a cello banjo, which was bigger, heavier. There were even a few bass banjos, massive things about the size of about 3 feet across, which never really caught on. But anyway,
job getting that in the car.
Because they're relatively easy instruments to produce, there's not a great deal of craftsmanship in knocking out a. It's more metal work than wood. So it was very easy for manufacturers, particularly in Boston, to bang them out quite quickly. So you would find in high society, there would be banjo groups, banjo orchestras, four players, eight players, sometimes quite large numbers of players. And if you've ever heard of a full-scale banjo orchestra, it's... You probably wouldn't want to do it too often.
That's a great way of putting it.
It boomed. And again, once it was a phase. It was replaced, I think, largely by guitars, mandolins, which are much more adaptable to different styles of music. The banjo is whatever size banjo, it's a very staccato thing.
Yeah.
So there's a limit to what you can do with it.
Yeah. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Island Life, A New World, Old Ways with David Kinley. And I'm talking to Mr. John Woodman about the history of the banjo.
you go back to Africa, there are, it doesn't matter what they're called, but a lot of the instruments from which the five-string banjo, as we now know it, had a shorter fifth string.
Okay.
Some didn't, but most did. And it was because they had that fifth string. Without the fifth string, you can't get a five-string banjo sound, which sounds a bit stupid. But that is what distinguishes the five-string banjo from most other string instruments.
Yes.
So
yes,
that's, I think, a lot to do with its attractiveness. There are very few other things that have that combination of notes coming from, you know, melody notes or rhythm notes, and then the pop, 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 mm-hmm. fifth string.
Interesting. So as we come to the Irish banjo, which is a tenor banjo, of course,
yes.
The first sort of there, when I can see it in my history books, it's around about the 1920s when it comes back over, when this instrument comes over to the British Isles and to Ireland. They seem to want it. However, you know, a lot of these places, instruments were built in Boston, which of course is a direct artery for between Boston and Ireland.
Yes. Yes, I know nothing of the history of the banjo in Ireland.
Yeah.
I suspect it doesn't go back beyond the 20th century very much.
I don't think so either.
But again, it may have been around. I mean, I first became aware of it in the 60s. That's what didn't me, but I've never been involved in Irish music, so I don't know.
Well, that fits in bang on the timeline of what I was reading about it. It was in the 1960s. It really got popularised by Dublin pub bands, and there was more broadcasting of it. There was more recording of it, so it spread And as much as we like Billy Connolly, his banjo playing, he's a damn good banjo player. But it those sort of comedians, I think trivialise might be a harsh word, but it did play down the prowess of this an amazing family of instruments.
The beginning of the 60s, you're beginning to see the beginnings of the folk room. You've got the Kingston Trio, who featured a five-string banjo, and it spread out from there. And that was the time when the really traditional players out in the six, up in Appalachia, started to be, quote, discovered.
Yeah.
Guys from New York who'd heard Pete Seeger and the rest, and thought, where does this music come from? Because nobody really knew. So they started to fan out, and they'd drive up at the weekends, pull up and say, right, anybody around here play banjo? And they'd go and listen to these old timers. They'd record them, and they'd bring them back. That was the beginning of the, not the boom, but the beginning of the spread of the old-time music scene in the US.
Of course, a big aspect of that is post-war investment in the United States and the road building into the Appalachian Mountains.
Yeah.
And, of course, television, broadcasting, newspapers, magazines.
Yes.
And I think it's safe to say that the Appalachian folk were sort of made into comic characters to a certain degree because they were isolated.
Yeah, so it's a sort of what was that television series? The Beverly Hillbillies.
Of course, yes.
I mean, there was, there still is a tendency of non country folk to look down on country folk, and specifically to look down on folks from the Appalachian states as being sort of primitive and untutored and unlettered. And, you know, I've been to West Virginia two or three times, and that is still resented. People there feel very much looked down on by the rest of America. They feel as if their musical heritage is not really understood, and which is a great pity. But I mean, that's how it is.
Yeah. Well, musically, it's an absolute fascination, isn't it? Because anthropologically, yeah. it's really quite traceable as well to yeah. where the songs have become. So yeah. if you're an historian or any sort of academic about music, you know, it's an absolutely fascinating subject yeah. with the banjo and yeah. what's happened to it.
Bluegrass is, I think, instantly accessible to anybody who listens to it. They listen to it and think, oh, wow, that's brilliant. And so it became very popular very quickly and still is to this day. But I'm not a bluegrass fan. I mean, I can admire it. I can listen to it for 5 minutes and then that's it. I've heard enough.
Yes.
It's clever. It's well done, but no, thank you.
It's mistakenly sort of seen as, bluegrass is sort of mistakenly seen as the American, that's how American music sounds, but it's a relatively new style, isn't it?
You've got all sorts of things feeding into that. You've got a big Christian bluegrass thing. Bluegrass is very much associated with American patriotism, so it's a different thing altogether. It's a very, very big thing. And then, of course, you go old time music, you go bluegrass, and then it's not a development, but you've got the growth of country music as we know it alongside of all that.
Yeah,
bluegrass, the bluegrass world and the country world are very separate, but they're not a million miles apart.
Well, there's a mountain range between them, isn't there? Yeah. It's wonderful how people have been recording all this in the latter half of the 20th century, in particular, like the Smithsonian Institute, the Lomax family. Yeah. And it's really well recorded, and it's fair to say if you go to the mountain there, the Appalachian Mountains these days, it's in good health. Their music, isn't it?
Oh, yeah,
the festivals and
there's a very strong tradition. A lot of it is family based, so they're all recognised musical families. So it's not just that. I mean, it's gone from being a music of the oldsters, of the, you know, primarily the rural poor. It's now much more widely based locally, and also there's a big interest in banjo and fiddle music across, not all across America. It's primarily an East Coast thing, I think, in California, but you don't get much of it in Texas, let's say that.
Yeah, that's for sure, yeah. Yeah. Well, we started this conversation in 1687 in Jamaica. I think we're going to finish off in the Isle of Man, actually. I found out there is a banjo player I'd like to play.
When was it, in 2025?
So we've gone through 400 years of the banjo family, all through everything from minstrel playing to ragtime, traditional mountain music. Yeah. What a fascinating subject. And thank you very much for your time, John. Wonderful.
My pleasure, David.
Thank you. We started in West Africa, went to Jamaica and Suriname, to the Appalachian Mountains where the banjo mixed with the Celtic music. Then we travelled to Ireland, and now we play out with a Manx tune by McTulloch Fannin, featuring the talented Mai Ying Lee Ellis on the tenor banjo. It's been quite a journey. Thank you. You've been listening to Ireland Life, A New World, Old Ways. You can listen back to this programme by subscribing to Manx Radio Podcasts using your usual podcast provider. Gáire Mhaoir, Emu.